Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast, a weekly question and answers about gear, techie stuff, and for climbing, mountaineering, and general adventureteering. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. This week, we're going to discuss keeping your hands and feet warm and some sort of communication technology stuff. What day is today? Today is Monday, I think, and I'm off to Saudi Arabia next week, so I'm decided to do like one podcast for the next few weeks. So this will be I'll just do that this techie sort of podcast for the next few weeks because I've got lots to do. Like I seem to have spent the last few months complaining about doing illustrations for my latest book. And in the process, I've got like a commission to do some illustrations for somebody else's book. So I'm doing that. Which is quite an interesting book. It's a book about someone who actually a friend of mine who wanted to do the seven summits, but the seven most classic summits. So he did the Nose, Amadablam, did a route on Mount Cook. And some, I can't remember, Alpamayo. What else did he do? Alpamayo. Climbed a route in South Georgia. So anyway, it's a friend of mine called Charles. And the Nose. So I climbed the Nose with him. And he's a really, really cool, interesting guy. And I think the book will be really good. Anyway, so Vertebra are publishing his book. I don't know what it's called. Something to do with the Seven Summits. So that should be interesting. I think that's coming out soon. Should also give a shout out for Classic Rock or Hard Rock. I don't know what it's called. Anyway, that Hard Rock book, check that out, Vertebra Graphics. Anyway, they should be sponsoring this podcast. So I had another interesting. Oh yeah, I'm going to keep my rambling down because I only have so many minutes a month I can upload podcasts, and I've only got 32 minutes left, so I'll keep the rambling down. But that just reminded me of the Seven Summits. I wanted to make a TV program called The Seven Summits, which is seven somethings. Like, if you don't come from Hull, you don't know what I'm talking about. But in Hull, they say summit instead of something. So it's like, so I was climbing with a famous comedian, and we were climbing some route. And I was like, we're nearly at the summit. And he was like, something what? Like I said, we're nearly at the summit. Anyway, so yeah, good old Hull kind of language. So I'll begin with my first question. So the question is from Anita. And it says, I have a question. How to improve circulation in fingers and toes? I climb ice in the winter. Here in eastern Canada, Quebec, I'll do the rest of this in Quebecois. I get cold as fuck. Ooh, language. I have all the gloves, the G2SM boots, and yet my toes are still cold. This past weekend, we climbed minus 20 and literally felt like I was going to pass out and my fingers are still tingling. Is it me? I'm a woman with bad circulation, in brackets, is this common? I don't think I have a condition. This season, I made an effort to bring a bottle of hot tea to drink a lot, to snack, to stay hydrated and fed, yet I still froze. So then she put supplements, enemas, do I just give up ice climbing, or should I suck? So this is an interesting one. I know I keep mentioning going to Denali in the wintertime. I do apologise, but it's kind of irrelevant here in that my wife Vanessa was one of these people where she said she was always cold, and you know, she didn't like the cold and all this kind of stuff. So what do? You take her to Denali in the wintertime where it gets down to minus 50, and you're up there basically for 2 months living in, like, you know, you have to sleep in 3 sleeping bags and maybe more than sleep. Anyway, but you're in this like super, super cold temperatures where you're going to get frostbite, you know, within seconds, you know, 30 seconds, you'd get frostbite. And she said she wasn't really, well, she did get frostbite, but apart from that, that was her fault. But she said she was like warm the entire time. So I would say that her problem, the same problem with a lot of people, is they just don't know how to dress properly for the cold. And which is down to, like I said, the biggest mistake people make with their hands is they think that gloves are going to keep their hands warm, which they're not. Like, gloves are a complete waste of time. Like, if you see some kind of wad, like, you know, minus 20 on the Grand Jurass, and he's just got his like thin gloves on. Like generally, when you're climbing in such cold temperatures, like I used to have, like I've climbed in like very, well, kind of thinnish gloves, like the old sort of, one of the best gloves they ever made was the old Black Diamond sort of dry tool glove. But I don't think they make it anymore, but you know, quite a thin glove. But basically, your hands are absolutely frozen. Now, I'm lucky I've never had hot aches in my life, and I would say that's down to knowing how to dress properly, which is, you know, maybe not. Maybe I've got, like, amazing circulation. But basically, when it's super cold and you're wearing thin gloves, which you might need to do if you're going to do, like, really technical kind of winter climbing, is you can, after, like, years of climbing, you can basically can tell when you're getting frostbite, which is not an easy, you know, but you can sort of tell when you're getting frostbite. So you're always basically monitoring your hands the whole time. And you, like when I was doing, if you're doing like sort of very, like more technical, you know, grade 5, grade 6 kind of mixed climbing in like super cold temperatures, then I used to wear like a thinnish pair of like leathery palmed sort of soft shell gloves, which they weren't waterproof. Like I've never wear waterproof gloves. And over the top of them, I had a pair of mitts that I could like push my palm and my thumb and my fingers out. So I would be like basically having this like two glove system, where when it was technical, I could climb with my hands out, my fingers out, and if I had to put any gear in, I could do it with my fingers with these gloves on. They were thin enough for that, but they were warm. They were thick enough to give me some kind of insulation, and also you always need to keep the metal off your fingers, and you also need to keep the snow off your fingers so you can brush the snow off. And then as soon as it was as soon as the angle was less or whatever, it wasn't technically difficult, I would immediately like flip my fingers back into my mittens. So I had this kind of, it's going to be a slight bulkier system. But I found with that system, I could climb in pretty, pretty cold temperatures, minus 15, you know, whatever kind of temperatures. And that worked really, really well. But it's actually quite hard to get the right combination of gloves to do that. Like I even end up like making my own mittens, because I don't want mittens where just my fingers stick out. You know, like the classic fingerless glove flipper mitt. Now I would say like they are still really, really good, the flipper mitts. But the problem with most of the flipper mitts is they're either badly designed or they're made out of that kind of thin fleece material. And a big thing for me is I want all my gloves and all my clothes, I want to be able to brush the snow off them immediately. So if you're like daggering up a snow slope and you have those kind of gloves on and they're fleece, then they're just going to sort of wet out and fill with snow and everything else. So they're my preferred mitten would always be like a shell with fiber pile on the inside or some kind of synthetic insulation. So it's very hard to find a flipper mitt that's made out of anything apart from fleece or membrane fleece, which is a real shame, really. And So the only alternative, like the you know, the do it all kind of alternative for me, if I was climbing in, if I'm climbing anywhere, unless it's like a proper technical sort of winter climbing, I would generally wear a pair of mittens, which are quite big, and like sort of fiber fill kind of mittens, you know, like kind of expedition kind of mitts. And I have them attached to myself with some bungee cord just to my where my elbow is. And then I would just whip them off. Like I would just climb with them like that, with nothing on the inside, just my bare hands. And as soon as I got to anything where I had to put an ice screw in or whatever, I would just whip my hands out, bare hands, and put the screw in, put some gear in, whip them back on again, and carry on going. And because they're fiber fill, like ideally you want ones which have like fiber pile palms or some kind of not fiber fill, because a fiber, like, you know, synthetic fill stuff, because that's actually quite, there's no friction. So basically it feels like there's kind of movement on your palm. You want your ice axe and the leathery kind of material and then the lining all to be sort of, all to be like sticking together ideally. Like Montaigne made me some really good gloves, which were I don't think they had anything in the palm. They were mitts. They had nothing in the palm at all. I think it was almost just like the grippy stuff. And they weren't made out of leather, because the leather could often freeze as well. That's a bit of a problem. I would always say that is like just to go for like a really good pair of mitts and just ignore all the gloves. Like the gloves are just a waste of time. And if you're doing like technical climbing in super cold weather, then I would also potentially recommend getting some like industrial latex gloves. You know, like the ones you can buy in B&Q and hardware stores. They're usually like a black material, and they're actually rubber. So they act like a vapor barrier, glove. And you just wear them on your hands, and they stop your hands, the sweat from going from your hands into the mitten. And if there's any moisture in the mitten, it won't stick to your fingers. Your hands have a little bit more grip. Like you could try some of the slightly thicker ones that people wear, and that actually works quite well. Like I wouldn't bother with that if you're going to do like a multi-day trip potentially, because it's probably not good to have your hands in rubber gloves for like multiple days. One last thing with your mitt system is you want the mitt, so when they're hanging from your wrist or from your elbow, like if you have them hanging from your elbow, or the other way is to have some cord that somehow goes up, like pull the when you're not using the gloves, the mitts, pull them over your shoulder so they're hanging underneath your arms. If you don't want them to fill with snow, if it's spindrifty, so they always want to be hanging kind of more down or like parallel, if that makes sense. So a lot of mitts have like a little clip loop on the fingertips, so they can hang down on the back of your harness. You don't want them to fill with snow when you're climbing. So you just kind of work out a system where when you take them off, they don't fill with snow, because you don't want to put your hands into snow. But even if you generally, if those kind of mitts are so warm, it doesn't really matter. So you can put things like, stick them in your hat, stick them in your mouth, you know, stick one glove in your mouth, not one mitten in your mouth, do your stuff, put it back in again or whatever. So there's no like perfect option, but I would say in my experience, all gloves, you know, are kind of a waste of time. You're going to get cold hands, and, you know, it doesn't matter how amazing they are. And also gloves are more expensive, they're more expensive to replace, and a decent pair of, you know, expedition, you know, black diamond, you know, whatever, are good. I think the last mitts I had these giant ones made by, again, this company called Wiggies. I'm not sponsored by Wiggies. They make some really cheap, but very, very warm mittens that seem to work quite well, even in like cold temperatures. That's like Wiggies.com. Like they're really low tech looking. They're like more industrial stuff. And some people get away with wearing those kind of leather gloves. You know, you see people wearing like the leather kind of ski gloves. But I think whatever it is, they've got to fit. It's much harder to get a glove to fit than compared to a mitten. And you don't have too many layers. Like I never wear liner gloves, you know, I never wear all these kind of layers because you have to be able to hold your ice axes. Like it makes a massive difference being able to not grip, do a death grip on your ice axes if your gloves are too thick. So it's the, you know, the grip, the grippiness is super important. I'd also like look at how warm your body is. Look at keeping your wrists warm. You lose a lot of heat out of your wrists. So, you know, make some like wrist warmers out of some power stretch or something. That's a good idea. Some people, if you've got like a really old sort of fleece, then one thing you can do is you can actually just cut the sleeves off and sew them into something else. So say you've got like a base layer, like, you know, like a decent kind of base layer, is you can just take the sleeves off another base layer or another like thin fleece, and you can just sew that. So you've got two sleeves. So instead of the classic like body warmer, you've got lots of layers on your body and less on your arms. You flip it. So you have, because you don't want to get really, really hot when you're ice climbing, mixed climbing, because everything'll steam up and everything else. So you can actually put more insulation on your arms, even if you just put it on your forearms. So just like play, you know, just play around with it, really. Make sure your layers are kind of not too tight. Like a lot of people wear these, like look really sporty, like they're going like downhill skiing or something. But make sure everything's not too tight on your upper body. You have to be able to move comfortably and, you know, like carry a belay jacket, like change into your belay jacket. Maybe have a second pair of mitts, change into your mitts. You know, don't let yourself get cold ever. You know, as soon as you get cold, that's it. You know, if you're static to the point where you're going to get cold, then you need to start jumping around, dancing around, or you need to be in your sleeping bag or whatever. So when it comes to feet, the number one reason people have cold feet, I think, is their boots are too small for them. If your boots are too small, you've got them like super technical, then your feet are going to get cold, probably. Just have a quick cheap break. Hang on a minute. I always like make a cup of tea before I do this, and I always goes cold. So having socks which are too small, I mean, having boots which are too small is a problem. If that's not the problem, like if they are a bit too small, then look into wearing like thinner socks. You know, it's a kind of bit obvious, really, but the old classic, you know, wearing like a thin pair of socks and a big, massive, thick pair of socks. Personally, I don't think that works so well with a lot of the modern boots. Like, I think the Sportivas, like the G2 SMs and things, I don't actually think they're designed. I feel like they're designed more to work almost like a rock boot. So you don't want this like ginormous amount of socks in there, because the boots themselves should be warm enough, you know, like without having to put loads and loads of socks on. Maybe like, I think I said last week before, like, you know, maybe get some bag balm, like put bag balm on your feet, make sure your feet in good condition. You could think about using some vapor barrier socks. You might not have enough room. I would probably again check out wiggies.com and get some of their Wiggies socks, which are like a synthetic sock. I think the company I was trying to remember the other day that made vapor barrier socks is a company called Vapotherm, which are in Canada or Alaska. And they also do like a vapor barrier mitten. And I expect they're very warm. And they're again designed to avoid moisture going into the insulation and sort of wetting it out. So I check them out. They're a kind of very obscure company, Vapotherm. And they do like a sock, which is made of fleece, which is like a vapor barrier sock, but it's a fleece one. And you just wear that next to your feet. Another way to keep your legs warm is consider wearing more trousers, like even wearing two pairs of, you know, just like get up the insulation on your lower legs. Like sometimes if you just put on two pairs of waterproof trousers, you suddenly find like you're like a lot warmer than you were before. You know, again, even if you've got like thin, even if you've got boots with thin socks on, just get some old socks and cut them off and make sort of like leg warmers out of them, so they cover the lower part of your leg. And like even like watch your knees, like your knees don't have any really any, they don't have any muscle on them or anything. So your knees can, you can leave, I feel like you can lose quite a lot of heat out of your knees, which is a bit weird, but often your knees are pressing against the ice as well. And I know when I'm bivvying, I often find my knees get really cold in my sleeping bags. I often put like my mitts like over my knees to try and keep them warm. Get a neat, if you're trying these things, get back to us and see if any work. But generally, it's like the simplest things that work. Like people are looking at, you know, some good mitts, like Mammut makes some quite cool mitts. They make a cool like lobster kind of mitt, and they make some, you know, cool like insulated expedition mitts. But generally, I think you'd probably find you could go with a $150 like all singing, all dancing Gore-Tex glove that like Black Diamond make, but you might find that a $15 like mitt for someone working in a freezer place might actually be warmer. So yes, that's my advice. See what my time is. I've only got we're on the clock. So right. So the next question is from Jared. I ended up finding a podcast. Great stuff. You ask people to send in questions. So in an effort to feed the content monster, it is a monster. What are your thoughts on how technology, in brackets, PLBs, communications, SAR, is changing the responsibility of the sport to be prepared for self-extraction? Does it make a difference to know there is a possibility of a rescue? Yes, I think it does. First of all, I'll cover the technology side. So I've been on, you know, I've been going on trips like a long time, since 1998 was like the first ever proper kind of trip you went to a remote place. We went to Patagonia in the winter time, and this was before the internet, before anything. And basically, I didn't ring home for like a whole month. And I think my wife thought I'd died or something. There was no way to communicate with anybody, really. There was like one telephone. And, you know, it was just like Argentina, even 98, it seemed like a long, long time ago. So I think the first trip I went on was someone had a satellite phone. I went to Alaska, to the Ruth Gorge, in like 2003 or something. And we had a satellite phone. And then from then on, like more and more sort of technology started appearing. And when I went to Greenland, we had like two satellite phones. And you start, you know, then I went on trips and you had like all sorts of technology. You had like an E-band and all this stuff you could like, you know, you could send bigger files. And then we had like, you know, you have like EPUBs and, you know, the spot devices and all this kind of stuff. And I think what's very important if you go on a trip is to be there, is to be like, I don't believe in, I'm not necessarily fully, like I'm often very wary of people codifying things into like the idea of balance. Like, oh yeah, life's all about balance. Like personally, I don't like that idea. I like the idea of whatever you're doing, you have to be completely doing it like kind of a Japanese kind of thing. You know, you're here, you know, you're a climber, that's what you're doing. You're not like a dad or a husband or a, you know, whatever. You are here 100% and you are climbing this mountain or you're doing this trip. And the only people you should be thinking about most of the time is the people you're with and thinking about them. So if you go on a trip and you have a satellite phone and people are constantly ringing home all the time. Sometimes you go on a trip and you have all this like lots of free data or lots of, you know, lots of minutes on a satellite phone. And, you know, people are ringing up all the time and they're sending their emails and they're getting messages and people are, you know, stressing them out. And, you know, I remember I once met Boga Ausland, who is, you know, this whole thing's been blowing up at the moment about thinking of Brady, you know, what he did in Antarctica, whatever, who's not really bothered. Anyway, Boga Ausland is like, you know, the real deal kind of, you know, there's no kind of polar exploring anyway, but, you know, long distance walking in the cold kind of person. And he had this story where he was I think he was trying to ski from Siberia to Canada. He was going to be the first person to do it solo, unsupported. And he was like, you know, 2 months, 3 months, however long it was a hell of a long time, all by himself, you know, scary polar bears, you know, it's hardcore stuff like the North Pole. Anyway, so he gets his satellite phone and he rings home and he's like, oh God, you know, my pulk is starting to break apart and all these things going wrong. And his wife's like, don't you dare fucking ring me up like this. I'm looking after our kids and I've got all this stress going on and you're off fucking skiing around up there. You know, she really like put him in his place. And there is that, there is an element of you don't want to, you know, that kind of communication backwards and forwards, it should really be for emergencies only. And if the worst thing to do is to say, I'll try and ring you next week or I'll ring you every day or I'll send a message or whatever, because if your technology breaks then and you don't send that message, you know, that's like living hell for someone on the other end. They're just going to be this, you know, it's bad enough anyway if you leave someone and you're going to do some scary shit somewhere. Even if you just say, I'm going to text you, you know, you need to have like a rock solid, you know, I'll text you if I get killed. You need to do it something like that, another way around, really. So, you know, there's a lot of responsibility of how you're going to use that kind of technology. And another aspect of it is this idea of like, oh yeah, I'll just pull the pin, I'm going to get rescued with this e-pair, whatever. But in my experience, when you want to get rescued, or when something is really, really bad is going on, there is no rescue available. So it can lead you into a false sense of, you know, like, you know, oh, don't worry. You know, like last year, we were getting to the point where we had no food. And we'd had no food for, you know, basically we'd had like one bag of pasta. And I mean like a small bag of pasta to last about 7 days for two people. So I think for the first 3 days, we had some pasta for our breakfast. And then after 3 days, it had all run out. And then we just ate the last bits of trail mix we had. Then the last sort of 2 days, we didn't have anything to eat at all. But you're in the sort of survival mode. You're in a tent, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but the weather was so bad. There was no way anyone could get to us. Like even the US Air Force couldn't get into where we were. And eventually, you know, people would have to physically ski across these mountains to try and get to you with bringing you some food or something. So I know the other times would have been climbing where things have got really bad and you thought, this is the moment, you probably need to get rescued. There's no way a helicopter's going to come and get you. And I remember a few years ago, when I went to Greenland, you know, got caught in this pitterack, this storm, that was just, you know, it's like 120 mile an hour winds, you know, like horrendous kind of storm. And you just know that by the time, you know, once your tent's disintegrated, everything's blown away, like your boots and your pulk and your skis and everything, and you're just exposed in the elements, you're just going to be dead long before anyone comes to get you. You can press the button, but someone's just going to come looking for your body. So it's really important to fully protect yourself. Like in Antarctica, we built, like a wall that was probably, you know, like 3 feet thick and sort of 5 feet high, like all the way around the tents we had. And we also built an igloo, which the igloo would stand up to like horrendous kind of, you know, more than a tent would do. We had an igloo and we made all these like preparations for something, you know, for something happening, because you know that A, there's no rescue in Antarctica. Like if you have an accident on Overtarna or, you know, some mountain there, there's no one to come and rescue you at all. There's like people who could come, like the cook, you know, from the Russian base might be able to come and drag your body and put it in a plane, but there's no kind of technical rescue at all. So at the same time, you know, you could probably download your emails or, you know, we're watching like the Mighty Boosh on an iPod and stuff. So I'd be very, very careful. So and another thing I'd be really careful of is depending on technology. Now, what happens is you think, right, we're going to do this trip. We're going to go to this place and we're going to take like a video camera and we're going to take a laptop and we're going to blog every day and we're going to, you know, we need like a satellite phone. We have to like attach it to this computer and then we need a solar panel and then we need a thing so we can plug the computer into the solar panel. And before you know it, you've got like fucking 50 wires and you've got plugs and you've got stuff that turns up from Amazon the day before you go, and nothing is, you never actually use the satellite, you never use the satellite phone properly, you've never got you never really charged anything with the thing. And the more technology you have, the more, like, I would consider any piece of technology you take as being broken. There's a 50% chance it's going to be broken on that trip. So basically, you have to take two of everything. If you don't want to get like completely screwed by some technical malfunction, you're going to take two of everything. So the only way to do that physically is to take the smallest amount of stuff as possible. So, you know, basically, if you have instead of taking some like big camera, you know, you can actually get like really good quality, you know, footage from a compact Sony, you know, really good quality compact camera. And if that camera can be charged via USB, like basically everything you have has to be charged by USB. You don't want anything you have to plug into, you know, like a proper socket, so you have to suddenly have an inverter and all that kind of stuff. So your camera, your communications equipment. So I would, unless you've done it before and you know you've got the strength and the wherewithal at the end of the day to write a blog and try and sit there fucking around trying to upload it from a satellite phone, don't bother. Like, just get a satellite phone and communicate with someone verbally and get them to write it down. You know, write it down, what you're going to say, ring someone, read it to them, get them to post it on your blog or whatever. But ideally, I'd even avoid using a satellite phone. I would just use something like an inReach Mini, which is pretty cheap compared to the kind of trip you're going to go on. Like, I would just take two inReach Minis, so you've got like redundancy. They both charge off a USB, and I would just like go with those. I would communicate with those. You can use them as an EPIRB, so you don't need to worry so much about not having carrying a separate EPIRB. An EPIRB is like a satellite location thing. You can do all sorts of stuff with it. If you're going to do a lot of writing via that, I would probably take a really cheap smartphone, like a thin smartphone. And I tend to find Samsung stuff works much better in the outdoors. Like, if you want to do really fancy stuff and you are going to want to upload stuff, then I would probably take like a Samsung kind of tablet or something, because I find they tend to work better in, you know, those kind of temperatures. And if you're in a cold place, like, everything has to be in a plastic bag, because as soon as you bring it from the cold into the warm, it'll like water condenses on it. And there's loads of like stuff you need to learn. And if you don't know all that already, then don't take it, because, you know, you just, you know, anything you take, you have to have used it and really understand how it works. Like, I would go and do a little mini trip, you know, go away for a week and take all this technology and try and post blogs, try and make some films with your camera, you know, learn what maybe you need to take, like a separate little microphone to get this better sound on a camera. Do you need like a little housing on your camera? You can put a little microphone on top of it, and loads of little tiny things. But you basically want like a communications package, you know, like make sure all your cables aren't going to break in the cold, or, you know, get really small cables so they're lighter and they take up less space, zip tie them all together so you don't lose them, and all these kind of little things. And you basically want like a system, communication system, that you can almost like fit in your pockets. You don't want a big MacBook Pro, and you don't want, you know, two Iridium phones and, you know, like an inverter. And when it comes to power, I would consider, I tend to find that unless you go in the right kind of place, then solar power is always a bit of a pain in the ass. It's never as good as it's advertised to be. So I would kind of more recommend just to maybe take a little bit more weight and just take some big battery packs. And the same thing with the battery packs, I would make sure I'd use them lots of times before I went away. So then, because you do get dud ones which just stop working. And, you know, like, I think on Denali we had three or four like biggish battery packs. And with those, we charged our head torches, we charged a lantern, we charged our inReach, our cameras, you know, we did everything. There was no way we were going to get like a, you know, a thingy to work, a dish, what do you call it? One of those things, solar panel to work. And you know, you have your batteries, mark everything, so everything's got a name, you know, or some identifying mark, and make sure that as you're running out of batteries, your final two batteries, you need like redundancy. They're the batteries which you're only going to recharge your inReach and maybe your head torches or whatever, because you know it's no good not being able to communicate and have to get rescued or die, but you've got like your cameras on full or whatever. And I think this it reduces the stress if you have two of everything. You know, it's not massively expensive. Like I think an inReach, you can get one for like, are they like 200 quid or something? They're probably that price coming down. And you pay like, I think it's like, you pay like a yearly fee to register it. And then you only pay when you're going away. And you basically communicate by sending like a text message. And you can send it, I think you send it to an email address or a mobile phone. And it's quite good because you only send these like very small messages. You know, someone can send you the weather every day and you can pick it up and you can just, you know, you can have preset messages if people want to know you're not dead and stuff. So, yeah. So that's it. So I think, have I gone over my time? Anyway. So that's it for this week. If you want to support this podcast and help me get a sponsor so I can pay for my hosting this podcast, then the best thing you can do is share it with friends and enemies. And I've got a backlog of questions, and I will try and answer them as soon as I can. But keep sending them in. I'm sure every time I do a podcast, you probably questions come into your head or things I'm talking about probably not very clear about some things. But no matter how stupid it is or obscure or seemingly unimportant, I can talk shite about absolutely anything. So anyway, thank you very much, and I'll talk at you soon. Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.